morning? Oh, that's mediocre. It's 9 o'clock on Friday. You've made it to the last day. Did you have a good evening last night, even if it was your family and friends or at the party? Come on, did you have a good evening last night?
Yes.
Thank you. Right, there we go. Thank you very much for making the effort to be here at 9 o'clock, especially if you had a late one and partied hard. My name is Hannah Gray, funnily enough, as the slide says, and this is my tale of becoming a technical manager, and hopefully I can impart some knowledge onto people who are either already in the role or thinking about this as one of their career paths. First of all, there has to be a disclaimer. I'm going to take some things as given. There are two topics that are talked about a lot when you have soft skills presentations, so I'm not going to cover them again. One is imposter syndrome. It's a thing. We all have it. I'm taking that as just kind of a base known assumption. And the other one is the importance of soft skills in the tech industry. It's talked about a lot. It just means that in my particular case, I'm being a total hypocrite and standing up here pretending like I know the answer. So in some of these cases, I know that I do these things. The difference is that I hope I recognise I do them and I'm trying to change them. So please don't take this as a I'm perfect and I've solved all the world's problems, because that's definitely not the case. I am going to limit some of the stories to protect the innocent. So if you're looking for some juicy tidbits, probably not going to get as many as you might like. So the most important thing, who the heck am I to talk about this and to impart my knowledge as if I'm all seeing and all wise and knowing? So my background, just for a bit of context, is I am a back-end developer by trade. I've been in the industry about 11 years. My forte is very much .NET and SQL. That's where I operated, and mainly in web applications, although a little bit of SharePoint and a few other things around the place as well. I am now the technical group, technical group lead at Xero. Technical group lead is a really fancy way of saying an ex-developer who manages other developers. One day I'll actually get my job title changed to that. And I'll explain what that actually means in terms of what does that mean in terms of responsibilities and what do I actually do. So it means I'm infamous middle management now. Yay. I really enjoy that part. I've been in this role. This is the first role I've had where there is no cutting of code, so I don't write code in this role. And I've been in this role for 1 year. So this is very much a reflection on my year and my lessons to date. A little bit about my story. So when I came into the industry as a grad, I kept being asked every year as part of performance reviews, what do you want to be when you grow up? I had no idea, right? I just liked doing development. I had no idea what the career paths were, and I ended up learning to hate that conversation. I really did, because I was made to feel like I should know what I wanted to be, and I didn't. And so immediately you get, you know, imposter syndrome and a whole bunch of other stuff kicking in, right? And so I didn't feel like I was in the right. I felt like everybody else knew what they wanted to do. I have a really clear memory of the day that I started, my first day technically in the industry as a grad. And I started the same time as two others. So we, you know, this was all of us. It was our first day at this job. And, you know, you're making small talk with these people you've never met before but are in the same position as you are. And I remember turning to one of them and I said, oh, you know, do you know what you want to do or what you want to be? And they said to me, just as quick as lightning, without having to think about it, yep, I'm going to spend a couple of years in the industry, I'm going to become a Microsoft MVP, and then I'm going to go contracting and make my money. And absolutely true to word, that's exactly what they did. So from day one, I'm comparing myself to this person who has this really clear career plan about what it is that they want to do. I have no idea, I just liked being a developer. And so there was such an emphasis on you must know what it is you want to be. So that went on for about 5 years or so of permanently feeling like something was wrong with me because I didn't know what I wanted to be other than just what I already was. You had to have a career plan. So inadvertently, I stumbled into success. Because I didn't know what I wanted to be, I just avoided the whole topic. And I just focused on doing the stuff that I enjoyed. And so, you know, the concept of climbing the corporate ladder, no. There was a big push to do corporate networking, you know, get your business card into as many hands as possible. I was out of university, like, you know, a year ago, and I was being told, you know, encouraged to do this. This was how you grow. This is how you form your career. And I didn't like that. To me, that was really, really forced. So again, I avoided it. I stuck my head in the sand and completely ignored all of this. And for some people, that's a very natural thing to do, to go out and network, but it wasn't for me. It didn't really resonate. But what I did find is that when I did the things that I enjoyed, I started finding what I was actually good at. Right? It's a total cliche. And so I found that what I kept spending my time on was things like process improvement. When I was doing coding and being a developer, the things that really resonated with me were things that had a direct impact on helping the user. So I ended up specializing a lot more in application support than in greenfields and new technologies and that sort of thing, because I loved that feeling of feeling like I was doing something that would make the user's life better or save them an hour or that sort of thing. And so I found those strengths. Eventually that morphed into me also spending a lot more time mentoring people, getting involved in graduate recruitment, internships, all of those sorts of things. And I realized that one of the things I was different from everybody else is I had this real obsession with communication and communicating really well to other people around me. I also found that actually I did have some real weaknesses. I remember a conversation with a colleague and they were talking about some bug in the .NET compiler. Intellectually, I kind of followed the whole thing, but my interest level was like right down here. That's not a conversation that I'm going to get really pumped about. And anytime any developer starts talking about tabs versus spaces, I just want them to hurry up and decide so I can get out of the room and get on with something. I suspect like a lot of other people. But it meant that I started specializing. And this wasn't by any guidance or anything else. This was just me doing what I enjoyed. Next minute, it all kind of blew up in my face in a good way. I ended up taking on HR responsibility for 5 developers, which then turned into now 10. I currently have 10 direct reports. Those direct reports are also people managers. So underneath them, I am responsible for an umbrella of 50-odd people, all of whom are technical in some capacity, from QAs right through to developers, front-end developers, and so on and so forth. A technical group lead, in my case, what that actually means is I am responsible for the quality of the software that is shipped. I'm also responsible for how we ship it, so the method of delivery, blockers for the teams, pod health, those sorts of things. And I'm also responsible for the individuals having everything they need to be able to do their job. That includes career advice, career opportunities, all those sorts of things, upskilling in those. So that's what a technical group lead is in my particular case. So this was kind of my path. I was a developer, then took on some technical leadership with a particular client. Then there was a team. We didn't have a product owner if you work in Agile, so I took on work prioritization. Then I got given direct reports and took on official HR management, which was quite late in my career, actually. That was only a couple of years ago that I actually took on official HR management. And then I just got into a heavily technical project and did, sort of more architecture, high-level thinking stuff. And then somebody decided it was a really good idea that I stopped cutting code, which I'm totally okay with. And so I became an ex-developer and continued the people management side. So that's where I am now. Is any of this sounding familiar to anybody? Yes, good, wonderful. Okay, we're on the same page. So here's what I learnt out of all of this. I have yet to meet, other than the person that I met on my first day in the industry who had a really clear career plan. Turns out most of us don't. And I really wish somebody had told me that. It's a thing. There are about 100,000 people, according to some random survey, in the IT industry in New Zealand. So I'm estimating about 100,000 people don't have career plans in the IT industry, give or take a few here and there. So that's normal. The other one is I found quite inadvertently that this whole networking thing that I had a real instinctive pushback about. I hate networking. If somebody said, you should go to this networking event, I'm out. I'm finding something else to do. But by virtue of me getting interested in the things that I was passionate about, I would have a work colleague invite me to meet somebody else. I would get invited to join a group of like-minded people. And I just kind of did what seemed interesting. And so next thing I knew, I actually looked back. It happened about a year and a half ago. I looked back and I went, oh my gosh, I've been networking. How dare you? That's shocking. And I really wasn't an intentional thing. But it was much easier to do, and it was much more in a style that I was comfortable with. And so my personal advice would be, unless you are a person who's totally comfortable with doing that sort of forced networking and glad-handing and all that sort of thing, it's okay. Just, again, do what you're interested in. The networking will actually follow by virtue of you just being passionate and doing what you do well. Another lesson that I learnt, Leadership, especially when you're a developer or in some sort of technical discipline, we conflate two things a lot. One of the most common career paths is for somebody to be a really good developer, and to reward them being a good developer and really technically strong, we give them people management responsibilities, which in my books is completely wrong. Now, I realize I can say it's wrong, but that doesn't change the fact that you might work in an organization where that's the case. They are two different skill sets. I'm sure all of you can think about somebody that you've worked with, or maybe a family friend, anything, who you would think is really good with people, good at mentoring or coaching or guiding or giving advice, all those sorts of things. They're probably not the most technical person who can give really good guidance about the best way to do something from a technical point of view. Anybody here know somebody who is great at both of those things? A couple of hands. Cool, all right, good. I'm glad that you do know, but they are rare, and that's all I want you to take away from this. They are very rare to have excellent people managers and excellent technical leadership in one. And part of the reason is that they collide with each other. So if you manage people, especially if you're in a direct team, and you have, say, five people under your umbrella, and you have to provide technical leadership as well as people leadership, how well do you think the people underneath you can determine the difference? If you tell them to do something, are you doing it as their manager who's guiding and coaching them and helping them in their career? Or are you doing it because you're the technical lead and therefore it's the way we should be doing things? And it's very hard for a lot of people to be able to tell the difference. A given, but you know, there's limitations. For me, the minute I got a title and got some responsibility, I had to be all the things to all the people, and I assumed that me taking on responsibility meant I had to succeed, right? I had people relying on me. I don't have kids. I kind of assume parents go through something very similar of, I must be able to be successful at all this. You're welcome to provide feedback and tell me I'm off base. The other thing is that people will, if you are successful at what you do, or even if you're just viewed as successful, doesn't matter if you're completely crying in the corner and people can't see it, people will think that you are the solution to their problems as well, even if it's not your area of responsibility. So it's very easy for somebody who's successful to get increasingly loaded up upon because they start being seen as a go-to person. They're the easiest person to get a reply from, easiest person who's going to point them in the right direction, and so on and so forth. So you have to be able to figure out how to deal with problems that are not in your area, not your responsibility. And you can't be all the things. If you try and be all the things, you will fail. And this is one of these moments I'm being a total hypocrite talking about this. I am still trying to stop being all the things. It's a bad habit of mine. And more specifically, you won't be able to do all the things. If you do try and do that, you will fail. It's really harsh to say, but it is the truth. By doing this, it's not that you'll succeed. If you manage to do this, it's not that you'll succeed more. It's just that you'll fail less, which sounds really negative. Sorry. The thing that seems to surprise most of my peers is that when coding was removed, the act of writing code was removed from my day-to-day duties. I was okay with that. I am still technical. I can still have a technical conversation. I'm still happy talking about technical things. It does tend to be at a higher level now. And I'm not going to evangelize .NET Core to anybody or tell them how to write their code. But the world didn't end, right? And it turned out that I'm actually happier now doing this role than I've ever been in the past because I no longer feel as much as an imposter as I did before because I always felt like I was technically lacking compared to people who loved .NET compiler bugs. Ironically, I have more trouble convincing other people of this fact than having any trouble with it myself. People don't believe me that that's a thing. And again, that's unique to me. Everybody's different. I'd really challenge anybody who's looking at going into the role about why they're going into a role of technical leadership or technical management. Anyone can lead. You can lead by what you do day to day. You can mentor people. You can coach people. You don't need a title to do that. Now, I say this with complete recognition that in some organizations, they don't recognize that. They only recognize it by title, and it can be a bit more hierarchical. So I realize I'm kind of preaching ideas that might not resonate. So I guess what I'd say is really think about why you're going for a management role and the reasons. Is it because you want to be recognized and get a salary increase? Then you're doing it for completely the wrong case. And to be honest, you're doing both yourself and the people that you will manage a complete disservice. Because if that's your motivation it will show in your actions. I see so many people who don't want to let go of coding. They like being technical. They're really, really good at it. They're like, you know, really good at their job. And for them, they see the only path as taking a management role, and they're not that good at it, right? And this comes back to this conflating people management and technical leadership. And they take a management role and they try and hang on to the coding. And it means that their focus is being diverted here when in fact there's bigger fish to fry. So again, I acknowledge that this won't necessarily work in every organization. I do encourage you to try and challenge the status quo if you can and if you're able. I'm very lucky, the company that I work at, we do differentiate. We have two different roles. We have people leaders and we have people that eventually will become architects and technical leaders. And they're two different career paths. So that resonates really well with me. Job descriptions are terrible, right? They are the most misleading documents you can possibly read. And I say that as somebody who writes them now, and I will rewrite them four or five times and they still won't get across the intention. And the reason is this, it's really hard to convey your idea of what a role should be about in words, because 10 people will read that job description and take away 10 completely different views about where the emphasis lies. If you ask them, you know, how much of it percentage is coding, how much of it is people management, you know, where should you focus the most, they'll have 10 completely different views. So just ignore the job description. My one says I'm really good at JavaScript, something like expert in JavaScript. I'm not. It's a bit of a joke. So focus on the intent of the role, okay? So just acknowledge if you're applying for a management role or anything like that, or even if you're in one, focus on the intent of the role, and if you find that you can't figure out what the intent of the role is, great, you now know the first question you need to ask. What is it you actually want this role to solve for your manager or whatever, right? Is it 50% coding? Because I'm holding on to that. Was that actually what you wanted me to do? So that's a really good conversation to have. You will lose sight of the goal. I've done this rather spectacularly. There's 1,000 things to do the minute that you become responsible in any way, whatever that form that responsibility takes. It's normal, it's okay, and you'll lose track of what it is you should focus on. The key to get around this is kind of twofold. One, use others to keep you on track. Now, this can be in any form. It could be your partner at home. It could be somebody at work who you have respect for and you touch base with occasionally and say, am I on the right page? Am I still doing the right thing? Am I missing something? Could be your manager if you have a good relationship with them. Totally depends on your situation. But find some touchstones that you can make sure that you're not completely missing it, because especially if you're new to management, this is a thing, right? And so just compensate for it. That's all you need to do. And when you do lose sight of the goal, and somebody says to you, you know what, I've got to be honest, you asked, no, you're not doing the things that are the most important things. That's all right. Go back to the previous part. Focus on the intent of the role. Go back to the beginning as if you were starting again. I did this recently. I took a week off. It was actually the encouragement of my manager because I couldn't see the wood for the trees. I had 1,000 things I was doing, and I wasn't doing anything particularly well. And she said to me, I want you to take a week off. I want you to tell everybody you're on leave. I did. I wasn't on leave. I was actually working from home, but everybody got me out of office, and it was really effective. And she said, I just want you to focus on what it is you want to do for the next 6 months. What are your goals? Just take time, get permission to step back. It was one of the best pieces of advice I ever got, and I came back with a completely clear idea about what I needed to do and what I should be focusing on, rather than trying to do that while also answering all the emails and going to all the meetings, because that's really hard. If you are in a situation where you don't have a manager that you resonate with, or it's a manager who's absent, or it just might be a manager who their style of management doesn't, you know, work for you, or it's, you know, catch up every month or something, work on your peer support network. And this can be, it doesn't have to be coaches and, you know, I'm not saying big group hug stuff, that's not what I'm getting at. One of the most successful times that I felt really supported was a group of four of us who were all peers at a sort of responsibility level, and we were very, very tight-knit in supporting each other and figuring out what it is we need to do on a day-to-day basis. I can promise none of us gave each other hugs, it's fine, wasn't that sort of thing, but I knew that there was somebody there to bounce something off, to check that email, to give me the support that I needed in the role that I was doing. I must point out this isn't about ganging up on somebody or ganging up on your manager. You know, it's not peer support like organising a mob to throw down your manager and take over the world. It's just about something that helps you get on with your day-to-day. So if you're not getting something from your manager that you need, find it elsewhere. Okay, so those are the lessons that I learned in my semi-hypocritical way of pretending that I've solved all of those. How not to stuff it up. So how many people here are already in some sort of technical, managerial, official role, something? Most of you, fantastic. Okay, who's thinking that this might be their career path or this could have interested? Less, okay, all right. Hopefully something here resonates with you. So a lot of this is gonna be soft skills. And it will sound like I'm only talking about people who have people management responsibilities. I'm not. I'm also talking about people who have technical leadership responsibilities as well. First thing, hopefully you have heard these terms: emotional intelligence, unconscious bias, and communication styles. Communication styles is sometimes also referred to as personality styles, DISC, Myers-Briggs, that sort of thing as well. One of the things that I think about these things is that we talk about them a lot with regards to ourselves and how we communicate with the person next to us. And I certainly walk away with the impression that we're expected to be awesome at this. We can instinctively recognize that somebody else has a different communication style, and I will fix the way that I communicate and everything will be hunky-dory. Doesn't work that way, right? The key here is actually not. That's not what I'm trying to get at. It's not that you can do all of that. It's that you can recognize it. Because I speak very much from experience when I say that your ability to recognize that one of these factors is at play makes a huge difference in the way that you act. Doesn't mean you have the solution, doesn't mean you know what to do about it, but you being able to recognize, okay, I just can't seem to get this message through to this person. I'm not communicating in a way that they can understand, I'm not talking their language. Don't know what to do about it, but it will mean that I'm less frustrated and I'm looking for solutions rather than fixating on the problem. So this isn't about being good at being emotionally intelligent necessarily, or unconscious bias or all of those, because that's a really hard ask. Certainly try, I encourage you to do so, it will help. But just being able to recognize it is a massive step forward when you are a leader of people, whether it's HR management or technical leadership. And the thing here that I would really challenge is that if you're sitting here and going, that's, you know, all sort of feel good stuff, that's exactly why you need to not be able to recognize it. It doesn't mean you have to believe it, it doesn't mean you have to buy into it, but your ability to recognize it is really, really key, because if you can recognize that other people don't think the way you do, it will change the way you act. It definitely changes the conversation. As a leader, people will be looking to you for how to react to things. It's an implicit expectation, one that most people don't call out. Change is a thing. And some of you might be internally laughing, thinking, I work for an organization where nothing changes. What are you talking about? That's the problem. Change does happen. It's just on different levels depending where you work. It might be that somebody resigns. It might be that the entire company is restructured. But people will still be looking to you implicitly about how to handle that. And sometimes you'll be not necessarily the instrument of that change, but it might be up to you to affect it. So the key here is you need to bring people along the journey. And again, if you're thinking, that's not my forte, whatever, again, just recognize that this is something that needs to be done. And I'll talk about how, if communications isn't your strong suit, what you can do to compensate instead. But that is your responsibility as a leader. It is not to dictate, it's to bring people along on the journey. Which leads nicely into the next one. You need to lead, not dictate. People respecting you and your decision, and yes, your vulnerabilities, will trump any fear of authority. If you think about people that you've worked with or for, who you have respect for, and what you would do for them, could be your family, you will do a lot more for people that you respect. And you'll have a lot more healthier of a team. Leadership is about releasing people and giving them permission and freedom. Management is about control. I challenge you to aspire to be a leader rather than a manager. It's very, very easy when things don't seem to be in control to try and manage them, to grip tighter. One of your responsibilities, if you're becoming a leader, again, is to just be able to recognize that you're doing that and try and step back. You'll notice a lot of the time I'm not telling you to do something because it's really hard to do this stuff. It's the recognition. I'm going to keep re-emphasizing that. The other piece of advice I'd give is stick to your word. Follow through on what you've said, positive or negative. If you set a deadline, you say you're going to communicate by X, then do so. You will earn a lot of respect by doing this. And it's really often the very small things. The minute you don't practice what you preach, you start losing buy-in to you having that leadership ability or being respected. If you find that you're having to dictate, something's gone wrong. And while it might not be your fault that it's gone wrong, it will be your responsibility to fix it. This is the joy of leadership. Welcome to the team. It was interesting. One of the things I got some feedback out of the blue that I didn't realize is there was a process that we asked teams to go through, and they had all agreed it was a reasonable process. And for several weeks, we had kind of let, you've done 90%, but you didn't check the final box. Just do that now, and we'll let you through. And we thought that that was the best thing to do, right? It was being lenient, it was being human, and all those sorts of things. Turned out the first time that we went, you know what, this is enough. This person here has not followed this process. Go sort your stuff out and come back next week. I immediately got communications from somebody who said, it is so good to see you enforce the standards that you've said will be the case, because I've been following those standards, and it's really good to see actually people realize that they have to pick up their game, because they'd been playing by the rules the entire time, and they felt it was a bit unfair. So I immediately got positive feedback. I hadn't realized that sort of impact, because I thought I was doing more to accommodate everybody and not stop people from doing their job, but in fact I was demoralizing people who were doing it well to begin with. This is a hard one, in tech companies especially. Try and reward impact rather than those people who do heroics. We have a really bad tendency to call out people who pull the all-nighter to get that code out and solve that bug, or the people who make something happen that we thought was going to take 3 months, but they do it by working insane hours and setting a standard that is virtually impossible for everybody else. And we tend to applaud them quite publicly. It's very much a public recognition thing. So it's very hard to realize how much that impacts other people. Very similar to the last story that I said. You as a leader, need to stop rewarding that. And you need to stop rewarding heroics by simply just letting them be, right? That is the easiest way you can do it. Doesn't mean necessarily slap people on the hand, but let them go. And then figure out why those heroics were needed. Right? We didn't plan well enough. So there was a complete deadline that we just simply weren't going to hit. The interesting thing is that when I recently did a survey for people in my teams, and we asked them, how do you prefer to receive feedback? This isn't what happens now. This is what they would prefer. And there were two factors that we were looking at, whether they preferred private or public feedback. And if it was private or public feedback, was it in a small group or a large group? Informal or formal. So informal can be just, pat on the back type stuff. A formal is maybe recognized via putting it in a system somewhere or written down or a letter thanking them, that sort of thing. By and large, clear and far away, regardless of whether it was formal or informal, people preferred private feedback. So we tend to promote these really big public, hey, everybody gather around, have a team meeting, let's give a round of applause to somebody. Actually, it was really interesting that people wanted private feedback more than anything else. And that comes back to rewarding heroics, because what we do publicly, I'm hoping some of you are realizing if you think back, what we tend to do publicly is in front of everybody else reward heroics, not the effort. Uncomfortable conversations suck. They really do. And uncomfortable conversations, I think some people, when they see this phrase, think about performance management, which is the extreme end of uncomfortable conversations. Uncomfortable conversations covers a wide range of things. It can be telling somebody that, you know, hey, you wanted a 10K salary rise, you got 9.5. And some people will take that really badly, right? It very much is individual. It can be simply saying, look, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get you to report to somebody else because I'm moving on to a new role. I've seen somebody actually delay that conversation for far too long because they didn't want to have to break the news. The advice that you will keep hearing about uncomfortable conversations is if you find yourself leaning away from a topic or not wanting to discuss something, then that tells you that topic is really important and you need to be discussing it. So lean towards that. Recognize when you're having that feeling and tackle it head on. Now, I need to be very clear because this has backfired on me once before. When I say tackle it head on, I don't mean tackle the problem head on because that's really aggressive and it will land you in trouble. I mean tackle your own instinct head on. So I'm not saying, oh, that colleague is really annoying me. I'm going to tackle it head on. When I get back on Monday, I'm going to like pull them aside. I'm going to tell them how. No, don't do that, please. It's not constructive. But realize that you haven't told them. And go, okay, right, I'm going to find this a little bit awkward, but I'm going to tell them. And I'm going to do it in a constructive, useful way. Okay, we're all clear on that one? I mentioned before that I personally think that there is a big difference between people and technical leadership, and you very rarely find excellent skill sets in the same person for both of those skills. So if you are a manager, or if you want to be a manager, decide. You can actually do this. A lot of people don't realize that they have the permission to do so. Decide what type of manager you are. Specifically, decide where on the scale you are. So it's not I'm going to be only a technical leader or only a people manager, but it's a seesaw. I'm right up at the sort of, you know, two-thirds along towards people leadership. And just decide where you are, because again, having that recognition internally that that's where you are will empower you to be able to say that this other part is not my forte, or I'm only dedicating this amount of time to it. The worst thing you can do for your staff is not acknowledge that you're mediocre at something, and therefore you won't compensate for it. Because they will be expecting you to be all the things. That's what they do. So again, it's your responsibility to be self-aware and be able to acknowledge that, okay, I'm not going to be a great coach and people manager. Yeah, I'll do the day-to-day stuff, but I'm not going to be able to help them that much on coaching and through personal life problems and all that sort of thing. That's not my forte. That's okay. Acknowledge that. And once you do, you can then start putting in systems to compensate. So, for example, you could be a manager who, as I said in this particular example, isn't so much a strong suit of coaching and mentoring and those sorts of things. And you might have somebody who is really struggling with stress levels or those, and you're sitting there looking at this person crying, going, I don't know what to do with that. Anybody been in that situation? Couple of people, yeah, that's an awkward conversation, yeah. It is hard, right? So let people know. You're allowed to be a leader and actually have other people help you. That's fine. So it might be in this case that you actually tell your reports, hey, look, I've kind of realized I'm not particularly good at career planning or coaching, so what I'm going to do is set you up with a coach over here. Or I'm going to do something else that compensates. You can do that, and in fact, your reports, if you have people management, will respect you a lot more for being able to recognize that, because you're clearly setting those boundaries. So figure out what type of manager you want to be, and tell other people what that is. It's not just in your head, you actually need to tell other people, because they'll change their expectations of you accordingly, and then they'll stop expecting you to be all the things. Trust me, that's a good thing. This one is near and dear to my heart. We are terrible at the assumptions we make about other people. In the same way that I make jokes about people expecting managers to be all the things, it almost always comes down to expectations. Almost always. Now, when I say setting expectations, I'm not saying that I pull somebody aside and say, right, this is what I expect of you. That's not it at all. It doesn't have to be formal. But a lot of the times when people are frustrated about things, it's because they haven't actually clearly said, this is what I expect of you. This is what I don't expect of you. How many times have you actually used the sentence, I don't expect this of you? It's quite rare. And in fact, that's probably one of the strongest ones. Somehow we expect people to just know or to work out that, hey, you've been here for 10 years, so I expect you to be doing this as part of your job. Nobody tells them. And then we get frustrated when they don't know or they don't act that way. So if you're finding yourself frustrated about, and again, this could be very relevant to peers as well, if you're finding yourself frustrated with a situation, ask yourself, have you actually set that expectation? If you have, okay, cool, so there is a problem, and you need to have that uncomfortable conversation. But I'll guarantee you that 99% of the time, you haven't actually said it in words. And I need to be very clear about this one, because this also happens all the time. People say, oh yeah, I set expectations. And I say to them, what words did you actually use? And it turns out that they implied it, right? That's not setting expectations. You need to actually form a sentence that clearly says what it is you expect, a whole sentence. It's, English is something you're gonna need to use in this scenario, right? A number of conversations that I have with people leaders and they haven't, you know, they've just implied a lot. Oh no, I made it pretty clear to them. No, you didn't. You didn't make it clear to them. This is what I do with all of my reports. First meeting I have with anybody who reports to me, I ask them these two questions, and we sit down with post-it notes. And they have one colour post-it note, and I have the other colour post-it notes. And you'll notice with these questions that, of course, depending on who's reading them, they're inversed. So if I read them with regard to my report, the first line for me is the second line for them. Does that make sense? And I ask them to fill out the post-it notes for each of these two questions. And we do it completely in silence, and we don't talk. And I get them to try and brain dump as much as they can about what it is they think I expect of them, and vice versa. And then we sit there and we match them up. Now, the matching up is actually not the point of this exercise, because the matching up is the really obvious stuff. When you get things that match, you know, both the manager and the employee both agree that that's new, that's fine. You know, move on, right? That's easy. The value in this conversation is the stuff that doesn't match. Because the number of times I do this and there's all these post-it notes left out that are either my expectations of them or their expectations of me, and the other person hasn't written it, that's where the valuable conversation lies. Because you sit there and you go, I don't expect that of you. You're fine, let that go. Not a problem. Or they expect something of me and I go, ooh, okay. I hadn't thought about that, but obviously that's important to you. So now I know that as your manager, if I'm going to be any good at it, this is clearly something of value. Or we figure out, if it's not my forte, again, we figure out some other way to compensate for that expectation. It is one of the most valuable exercises that I've done. This is the other one that, hilariously, anybody that I work with will kind of be sitting there nodding their heads. Just ask. Oh my gosh, all of my reports, hilariously, they're getting used to this now. It's become an in-joke with the people who report to me because I'll just sit there and I'll listen to them talking about something and I'll be like, have you asked? Have you actually asked them? They're starting to learn to preempt it, which is good. You know, conversations like, I'm not sure if this person is happy. I don't really know what this person wants to do. I don't know if they're expecting me to do X. I'm not sure why they can't seem to click that they need to follow this process. All of those sorts of things, all of those frustrations, have you actually asked them? Again, 99% of the time, nobody asks them. And by ask, I don't mean confront, right? This isn't about being aggressive, being like, man, you're being such a prat. You need to do, but it's not it. It's about saying, hey, did you actually realize that this was having an impact? I get the impression you're concerned about this thing. Can I help? And asking, the number of times asking has made a huge difference in that conversation that's going on. One very much was the impact. Somebody was saying to me, you know, they don't seem to realize the impact this is happening, and you know, it should be really clear. We're in all these meetings and we talk about the troubles that are going on. And I said to them, have you actually said to them that this is what's going on? It's not a confrontation. It was simply asking them, are you aware? Oh, no, I guess I should, shouldn't I? Yes, Guess what? They asked them and the person wasn't aware, and now they're trying to change their behaviour. Now, that's potentially a more interesting example because it could be seen as a confrontation, but it applies to really simple things as well. People saying, I don't know when they... something as simple as, I don't know when somebody wants to take leave, they haven't booked anything yet. Have you asked them? Seriously? It goes on and on. I could print this on a banner by my desk. Just ask, right? It's overwhelmingly positive when people do. And as you might get as a bit of a theme out of my slides, communication is everything. It really is. Most people who've been doing management in any form, even technical leadership, will tell you that most problems are people problems. Yeah? So the question then becomes, you know, I've talked a lot about recognizing yourself that you can or can't do something, where your strengths lie. So what if you're not good at communication? What if you don't value high levels of communication and you don't think it's worthwhile? Okay, A, recognize it. B, recognize that people underneath you will think differently. That's okay. And then figure out how to compensate. If you don't find value in communication, that's okay. Find somebody else who does. You might be on a team and you find somebody that, you know, keeps saying, oh, you didn't tell us. Bring them into the fold and say, look, I'm not that great. I've got to be honest. You know, I'm more interested in solving the technical problems. I acknowledge that there is an issue around communication. Help me out. Ask for their help and I will guarantee you they will give it. Absolutely, they will give it. So you don't have to be great at communication. That's the point of a lot of this. You don't have to be the best thing. You just need to be able to recognize that it's something that needs to be addressed, and it doesn't have to be done by you. You can also change the style of communication. Communication doesn't necessarily mean that you get your team together every day and you give them an essay length. It could just be you work out a communication style that works for you. For me, I have different communication styles with different people. For my wider team of 50, there's a newsletter that goes out once a week. It's short, it's concise, it has all the relevant things that I think they should know. And that's worked actually really well. For my people managers, we've got, you know, sort of Slack, Flowdoc equivalent, and it's just, you know, bitsy stuff, because that's what they're interested in. So you can find out the sort of communication channel that you want. It doesn't have to be standing up in front of anybody. Yeah, get other people to help you compensate. If you have a lack of time, which is the number one thing, that's one of my big problems, lack of time, get other people to help you. Just bring them on the journey with you. Every problem I deal with is a communications issue. What's the blocker stopping this project? You haven't talked about it. What are the problems that you're having now that you need an architect to help you with? You haven't talked about it. Team going off in the wrong direction, and maybe losing a couple of weeks to, sort of realizing that it's not the right solution, you didn't talk about it. It's almost always, regardless of a technical or a people problem, it's almost always a communications issue. The technology issues are, right down here. Last but absolutely not least, as I said, the big theme about this is being honest with yourself. Recognize your limitations. And just recognize that it's okay to have those limitations and compensate. You won't be able to do all the things that I've talked about. If you do, send me a note, you're Superman or Superwoman, and I want to become part of your fan following. So aim for a few, right? Just aim for a few and being able to recognize them. Know who you are, know what you're good at, and what you're not. This isn't about being touchy-feely. Right? If that's not your sort of personality style or communication style, that's totally okay. This is not about that. But it is about the fact that people will support you, forgive you, and help you through all sorts of transgressions. You can do some truly horrific things, and people will support you and forgive you if you are honest with yourself and with them around what they can expect from you. And you will find your job a lot easier as a result. Last but not least, please fill in your survey forms. I hope there was something that you took away from this that was of interest. Thank you very much for coming, and enjoy your morning tea and the rest of Friday, and really appreciate it. The school.